good evening, everyone. Welcome to our next module of Discovering Buddhism, which is all about karma. And this, as you know, is our esteemed teacher, Robbie Watkins, who's going to tell us all about karma. So there was a handout, a few handouts. The page that has the big black mark on it is just general information about this module. We usually hand out a completion card the first night, but we're not going to do that. We'll hand it out next time. Right, Robbie?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there won't be a completion card for you, even though it's referenced in here. This page are instructions on how to access the FPMP Online Learning Center. That's where some of your readings will be and the requirements for the course. This is homework for this week that Robbie just distributed. And the two texts, everything's available on the online learning website except for two texts, one of which is Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. It's available in the bookstore. We also have a few copies in the member library. The other...
You have to read the entire book.
40 pages.
Yeah.
40 pages. And the other book is Healing Anger by His Holiness. And we're keeping this behind the counter. We just opened the box where this is. So if you want to buy this tonight, it'll just go to where you pay and they have it there. I think that's all I have to say.
Okay. That's all you have to say?
I think so.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, good evening and welcome. As Joanna said, we're beginning our module on karma. This is one of 13 modules in the two-year course Discovering Buddhism. We'll be here for six Monday nights. I like to start on time and I like to end on time. I actually like to end a little bit early if that's possible. My name's Robbie Watkins. I've been a member of Kadampa Center since 1993, and I've been studying Tibetan Buddhism since 1980. I'm not a teacher in the way that Geshe Gelug or Geshe Sampo are, but I'm someone who is up here to facilitate the discussion, and I think we'll have a lot of discussion in this course. This is one that, for some reason, I get to teach this one and the one on mind and its nature and the ones on emptiness, which is fine with me because they're great courses. I really enjoy teaching them. Just to say a little bit about the two books that Joanna mentioned, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. I'm not going to be referring to that specifically in this course, but this is a fantastic reference book if you're studying Tibetan Buddhism, and it's something I go back to all the time. It's a little bit formal. It's not necessarily our experience, but this is the party line according to Tibetan Buddhism. Great reference source. And particularly the section on karma, which is the subject of this course, would be worth reading. It's not really that long. It's referred to here as Observing the Law of Cause and Effect. And it starts on page 385 and goes through, it's pretty clear, goes through 423, so it's not really very long, section on karma. Healing Anger is a wonderful book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and it's not specifically about karma, but it really touches on a lot of the ways that an understanding of karma influences our life and can help us. I'd like to get an idea of who we have here tonight. Do you have anybody who's here at Kadampa Center for the very first time tonight? Okay, some people. Okay, that's great. How many people here were in the last module, The Path with Don Brown? So we have a fair number who are repeating that. And who has taken the course on, has anyone taken the course on karma before? Okay, a couple people. Was I leading it? Do you take it with me or with someone else? Okay, Venerable Tendron taught it about 4 years ago, and then I taught it 2 years ago. So if nobody took it with me, I can use all my jokes and lines again. And you'll think they're very fresh and witty, yes. Like I say, we encourage people to do the homework, do the completion card, which we'll hand out next week, and take the whole series of Discovering Buddhism for, as we put it, credit, because that way if you do all of them, you get to sit up here and lead the course, and we need more people to lead this course. Let's see, Susie, have you done all of them? What? Yeah, so you're going to be up here before too long. Okay. Let's see. How many people are going to try and do the whole two-year module? Okay, and fill out all the completion cards. Great. Okay. That's wonderful. The most important part of this module, I think of any of the modules, is the meditations that you'll do at home in between the Monday evening classes. I'll give you some things to think about. We'll have some discussion. We'll talk a little bit about what all this means. But really, sitting at home on a cushion doing your meditation practice is the core of this module, I think, of any of the other modules. So I'm going to just start off tonight with a little bit of a review about what meditation practice is, since we have some new people here. And for those of us who've been coming a while, it's always a good thing to do. Does anybody know what's the Tibetan Buddhist definition of meditation? Somebody should know that by now. Yes, to become familiar with. Okay, it's a mental process by which our mind becomes familiar with the chosen object of the meditation. So in the Tibetan tradition, meditation is not blanking out or going to no thoughts or spacing out. It's really a very active but concentrated mental state where we become familiar with the chosen object of the meditation. And hopefully the object of the meditation is a virtuous object. I mean, we could sit in meditation on rape and murder and killing and stealing and lying, but that wouldn't really get us where we want to go. So we sit in meditation and we become familiar with compassion, patience, love, various virtuous mental qualities. They're said to be virtuous in that they calm the mind. They remove agitation from the mental stream. And one of the key teachings, I think, in the Buddhist path is that as we become familiar with these qualities, our mind changes and becomes like those qualities. We become what we meditate on. I think a lot of us have a lot of experience with meditating on anger and irritation and impatience, and we naturally fall into those ways of thinking. But if we meditate on love, compassion, kindness, those qualities grow in our mind stream. Our mind, which if you took the module that I taught on that, you know, is the non-physical aspect of our being. It's not the brain, it's related to the brain, but it's the non-physical aspect of our being that perceives, that knows, that understands. And all of Tibetan Buddhism is about developing positive qualities in our mind stream. And you know, we look around and we look at all this imagery and all these colors, and it's very bizarre and foreign looking if we're new here. After we come for 20 years, we start to get a little bit more comfortable with it, but it's still not what we're used to. But everything up here is for the positive aspect it has on our mind stream. And so no matter how esoteric or bizarre or elaborate the teachings or the practices are, it's all about developing your mind to develop those positive qualities, because those qualities lead to happiness. The more we can develop them. So if we meditate on them habitually, our mind changes and those qualities exist there more naturally. So that's what meditation is all about. It's nothing mystical. There's nothing weird about it. It is becoming familiar first with what's already in our mind stream. There's a lot of negative stuff there, and we need to be aware of that. We can't just push it aside or pretend that it doesn't exist. So when we start to meditate, lots of times we're disturbed by the stuff that comes up, or we see how agitated our mind is, or how uncontrolled is, and that's perfectly okay. And if you're new to meditation, don't be alarmed by that. That's a very natural part of the process. But then we begin to see that there are little glimpses of compassion and love and patience there, and that those can, through meditation, we can develop them so they become the natural way that our mind functions. As Venerable Rabina, who is a wonderful teacher who comes here every year, said, Buddhism is just about developing new habits. It's nothing more elaborate or nothing more ethereal than that. It's just developing new habits, new ways of thinking. Okay, it's just training our mind to think in ways that lead to happiness. So meditation is the tool that the historical Buddha gave us to develop these qualities. So we become familiar with various aspects of our mind and various positive qualities. And that's all that meditation is. It's the Tibetan word for meditation is GOM, G-O-M. And this room we refer to as the Gompa, which means a room for meditation. So all we're doing is sitting and becoming familiar with our mind and its potential. Okay? So, rather elaborate introduction. So I'd like to start with a little bit of meditation. But before we do the meditation, it's good to do some prayers. And people say, you know, the question in Buddhism is, there's no God in the Buddhist view of the world, of the way things exist. So what are you praying to when you say these prayers? Let's see, where are the daily prayers? Page 34. Okay, I don't know this new prayer book yet. I miss the old ones. Okay, the daily prayers. So the question is always, what or whom are we praying to? And when we ask Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, this, he says prayers are aspirations, things that we aspire to. And we do them because they make a positive impression on our mind stream. So we're not really praying, or this is my interpretation, you'll hear other people say, praying to anything outside ourselves. And you know, you'll notice that most of these prayers in the terms of may this happen, I hope this happens. Okay, so this is, again, starting to develop our mind stream. It said that doing the prayers is like tilling the soil before we cast the seeds, which is our meditation practice, into the soil to grow. So we need to till the soil, get it prepared before we do the actual meditation. And, you know, a lot of the great Tibetan teachers, they say, you Westerners are such terrible meditators. I mean, it's just hopeless. You should probably do about 95% prayers and 5% meditation. You know, you really need to spend your time tilling the soil. Now, I'm not going to buy into that proportion, but that gives you an idea of how important the prayers are. So we'll start on page 34 and page 35. We'll recite Going for Refuge in Bodhicitta, Four Immeasurables. We'll do the Refuge in Bodhicitta three times. That's traditionally done three times. Then we'll do the Four Immeasurables, and then we'll do the Seven Limb Prayer. And we'll stop there. And you may not understand these. These may sound very strange, but as the course goes along, we'll look at what these mean a little bit. Okay. And it's traditional to put your hands together with your thumbs touching in between your hands, said to represent the union of compassion and wisdom. Compassion being the male aspect of enlightened, wisdom being the female aspect, the two necessary components of enlightenment. But if you don't want to do that, that's fine. So let's do the Refuge in Bodhicitta three times. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. Practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulate since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence, and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Okay, so you can see how everything is a wish, an aspiration. The only thing there where we're directly asking something outside of ourselves is in the seven limb prayer, where we say, please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. So that's where we're actually requesting the Buddhas, the enlightened beings who exist now in the world that we live in. We may not recognize them, but there are enlightened beings. We're asking them to stay and turn the wheel of Dharma to teach. Okay, the Buddha, a Buddha, an enlightened being, cannot save us or rescue us or remove all our sufferings. All a Buddha can do is teach us. And if we have the appropriate karma, we can receive an understanding of those teachings. So all we're doing is saying, please teach. Okay? That's all we're asking for there. But we're not saying, Buddha, save me. Buddha, make me happy. Buddha, take away all my problems. We're saying, Buddhas who are around me, just teach me. Please do that. Okay? So those are the prayers. And we'll talk a little bit more about those as this course goes by. And so now we've tilled the soil, and we can begin our meditation practice. And for those who are fairly new to this, we'll review the posture. There's nothing holy or spiritual about the posture per se. The goal with the posture is to establish a stable, non-painful, the point is not to put yourself in physical pain, but a stable, non-distracting posture that's self-maintaining. So once we establish it, it kind of holds ourselves, so we don't have to pay attention to it. So if you're sitting on a cushion on the floor, it's good to sit primarily on the front third of the cushion. You don't want to be towards the back, but you want to be towards the front, so your pelvis is a little bit open. If you're sitting in a chair, you want to be square on the chair. The back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Okay, you're not rigid, but just a little bit straighter. Sometimes the posture is described as regal or king-like. So our back's a little bit straighter. Sometimes they say, imagine you have a rope attached to the crown of your head, and you take it and toss it over a beam below the ceiling, and you just pull the rope a little bit, so you're just stretched up a little bit, but not painfully so. Your head is straight on your shoulders, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, not more than that. Not your chin on your chest, and not to one side or the other. Eyes are either lightly closed excuse me, or said preferably just very slightly open, looking about a body's length in front of you, but not really focusing on anything. But if you find it's more comfortable with your eyes closed, that's fine. Jaw is lightly closed, not clenched. Said you should place the tip of your tongue above your upper teeth on the ridge of the gums there. Shoulders are down and a little bit back, not hunched forward. A little bit back so your chest is open. Upper arms are away from the side of your body to allow a little bit of air to flow in. Hands are in a posture that you find stable. You can, on your knees is fine. The most traditional position in Tibetan Buddhism is right hand on left, with thumbs slightly below your navel. And your legs, there are a multitude of positions you can put in your legs. If you're comfortable in the full lotus position, go for it. If you want to do a half lotus with one ankle up on top of the other, that's good. If you want to do what's referred to as a tailor posture, like I'm sitting in now, that's fine. Or if you just want to cross your legs, that's good. If you're sitting in a chair, you have your feet flat on the floor. If you want to put a cushion under your feet to raise them slightly, that's fine. And when you get to the more elaborate meditations, you'll find that the posture opens up these energy channels that are said to exist in front of the spine that the winds or energy winds flow through, and the consciousness is said to ride on those winds. And this is really important when you get into the elaborate tantric meditations. But just when we're doing simple meditations now, if we keep our back straight and those energy channels which start in our head and go down to the genitalia, so that's helpful for even very simple meditations. So check your posture now, and if you feel any sources of tension or discomfort, deal with those now. Don't wait till you're halfway through your meditation to finally say, I can't stand this any longer. And now to just help settle everything, take three deep breaths with your stomach expanding on the in-breath, so your diaphragm is pulled down. Get a really deep breath all the way into your lungs. And then exhale with the stomach contracting towards the spine, just three times. And now allow your breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we're going to take a moment, and at the beginning of every meditation, it's good to set your motivation for doing the meditation, to be very clear and honest with yourself about that. And any motivation is fine. If you just want to relax a little bit, that's great. If you're doing the meditation just out of curiosity, that's fine. If you're doing the meditation to calm your mind, that's wonderful. But it said that the most powerful motivation for our meditation or for anything we do is what's referred to as the bodhicitta motivation. The thought that I'm doing this motivation, this meditation, to develop my mind so I can be of greater benefit to all living beings. I am changing my mind so that I can help all living beings, my friends, my co-workers, those people I like, those people I don't like, those people I don't even know, and myself. So it seems a little bit awkward, probably. We don't normally think that way. But see if for a moment you can just, even if it requires effort, generate that motivation. And having set our motivation, now we can do the actual meditation. The chosen object of this meditation is the breath. We're going to become familiar with, become aware of, the physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through our nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. We just take our mind and place it on the movement of the breath. The physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through the nostrils. Nothing but that. And every time we notice that our concentration has wandered away to a sound or a feeling or a thought of something we have to do later today or something that happened today, we just set that aside and come back to the breath over and over and over again. We're not thinking about the breath or describing the breath, just direct perception, mind and breath. And now we'll end our meditation by, as always, doing a brief dedication. We acknowledge that we've made some effort, that however distracted our meditation seemed to be, we have made a positive imprint on our mind stream. We've changed our mind very subtly, but in a positive way. So we acknowledge that and rejoice in it. And we dedicate the positive energy that we've created so that it may be of benefit to all living beings. That's a very simple meditation, and that's the standard format that we use. Start with some prayers, then a little bit of deep breathing to settle the mind, then setting the motivation, the actual meditation with the chosen object, and then a dedication. In that meditation, the object is the breath, which is a fairly neutral object. We don't have a lot of hang-ups about it usually, if we're in reasonably good health. It's always with us, so it's a very convenient object. And we're also becoming familiar with our mind's ability, or maybe initially seeming inability to concentrate. Okay, I think people notice that their mind was sometimes with the breath, sometimes not with the breath. And concentration is not a quality that we're encouraged to develop necessarily in this modern world, but it's one that the Buddha, it's one of the necessary mental qualities that we need to become enlightened. Okay, we can't become enlightened just by watching our breath. That's not adequate. But that ability to concentrate on the chosen object is something that we'll need as we progress along the spiritual path. So it's a very positive quality just to develop concentration, the ability to keep the mind on the chosen object. And that's something that will come up in every meditation practice that you do. Any questions or comments about that meditation? Everybody seemed very quiet and not fidgety, even when the trains were going by. But, yeah. So if you have any we're going to ask throughout this course, if you have questions or comments, that you speak into the microphone that we'll pass around, because we're being listened to and watched by people around the world on our live stream. Yes, there are thousands and thousands of people out there listening to us tonight. At least two we know of, yeah. Any questions or comments? I think most people are familiar with that meditation practice. Okay. Okay, so the subject of this module is karma. Who can define karma? Action. Okay. What does that mean? Action. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mhm. So what does it mean? Like going outside and throwing a rock? Is that an action? Yeah. Okay. Karma means action, by which we mean any action of our body, anything we do physically. Anything, an action of our speech, anything we say, or an action of our mind, anything we think. Okay, all of those are considered karmic actions. Anything we do physically, anything we say, anything we think. Okay, those are actions. actions that make an imprint on our mind stream. Okay? And this, the traditional Buddhist idea of karma is based on the concept of a mind, our mind stream, our consciousness, that is without beginning and is without end. How many people here took the module on mind and its nature with me? So you're familiar with this. Some people didn't get it. But according to the Buddhist philosophy, our mind is without beginning. It has had multiple rebirths where it's attached to different bodies, but the mind itself is without beginning. There is no first moment of mind, and it is without end. There is no last moment of mind. So it said that every action, every karma, everything we do, everything we say, everything we think, the least little thought, makes an imprint on our mind stream, or you can even, better way to say it is, plants a seed on our mind stream that will grow and ripen at a future point in time. We will inevitably, without exception, experience the results of all of our karmas, all of our actions, without exception. Everything we do, everything we say, everything we think will be the results of that will be experienced in the future. Okay? So it's very easy, I think, when we start talking about karma to get into a kind of materialistic definition of I hit somebody in this life, in the future life, somebody will hit me back. And I don't find that particularly useful or particularly profound or a very valuable way. I think for me, certainly karma, I think about it as a psychological or mental phenomena. That the way I act, the way I talk, the way I think now will determine my future experience. Okay? Makes imprints on my mind that determines my future experience of life. If I want to experience people being kind to me, people being generous, people being patient, I need to plant those seeds on my mind stream. That's the only way I will experience that. The seeds that I plant now inevitably determine what I will harvest in the future. If I plant seeds of anger, irritability, impatience now, that's what I will experience in the future. It is, well, the Buddha did not invent karma, okay? Karma is like, we frequently compare it to the law of gravity. It is a natural fact, according to the Buddha. This is something he observed when, in his quest for enlightenment, he sat under the Bodhi tree and looked at his own mind. He saw the reality of karma, the truth of karma. In the same way that gravity is a truth, karma is a fact of nature, according to the Buddha. It is the ultimate fact of nature. It said that karma is the deepest and most profound teaching of the Buddha. It is the deepest and most profound explanation he gave of the way things exist, which is what all his teachings were about. He was describing reality as he saw it. He wasn't making things up or inventing things. He was describing reality. He said, karma is the deepest explanation of how the world exists. It's the most difficult topic in all of Buddhism, also according to Buddha. He says it's the most difficult to understand. We can talk about it in some very sort of simplistic ways, but we need to realize we are not getting to the ultimate deepest nature of karma. But karma is very, another word that's used, it's said to be impersonal. Okay, there is no God who is determining the laws of karma. We frequently refer to it as the law of karma or the rule of karma. It's very much like gardening. If you plant a bean seed, you're going to get a bean plant. You're not going to get you're not going to get broccoli, okay? If you plant cauliflower, you're not going to get carrots. If you plant anger, you're going to get anger. If you plant happiness or compassion, you're going to get compassion. It's just very impersonal. There is no God determining this. This is the nature of the universe.
Okay.
Yeah. Any comments or questions so far? What are some words that, what are some synonyms for karma that people can think of? Or some other, or what comes to your mind when we use the word karma? Fate. Oh, okay, that's a good one. Okay. Were you raised a Presbyterian? Predestination, is anyone going to go there? Okay, what else?
Sow what you reap,
yes, uh-huh. So, what you reap, or you reap what you sow, or whatever. Okay, yeah, what else?
What goes around comes around,
yep. Uh-huh. Okay, what else? Yes, uh-huh, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Reciprocity, that's a good one. Okay. What else? Anything else come up for people? Does anyone think predestination? Does that come up when you think of karma? That everything's played out? That there's no free will? How about punishment? Anyone think punishment? Payback? Okay, karmic payback, you could say that. Cause and effect, yeah, okay, that's an important one. That's what we often use that. The law of karma is about the cause and effect. Now, anyway, that's a pretty good list.
The word faith.
Yep.
Everything else you put there. Because faith, I hate to say.
Speak to the world, yes.
Okay. The word fate is different from all the other phrases because fate becomes what you were saying about predestination.
Yeah.
It's already been set and you have no control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a little bit different. Yeah, and we'll talk about that some. I mean, a lot of people feel when they start studying karma, sounds like everything is already determined, that there is no free will. And to a large degree, most of us right now, we can say we are victims. This is a phrase. We are victims of our karma. Okay? We don't have much choice about how we experience our lives. Everything that happens, from the smallest to the most significant, is a result of our karma, of actions that we have done in the past. Okay? I mean, this gets down to the basic question of, why do bad things happen to good people? Okay? That's what the Buddha is talking about here. Why do good things happen to bad people? That's even more irritating sometimes. Why do good things happen to bad people? And you think about this. One, it could just be chance. Right? Okay, just randomness. The universe is completely random. We're just accumulations of molecules that are floating through the universe, bumping up against things that have no essential meaning. Okay, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's a creator God who's pulling the strings in one form or another. And then the Buddhist point of view is that it's karma. It's all the result of our past actions. Okay, so everything that we experience, everything that happens to us. Everything we come into contact with is the result of some action that we've done in the past. More than likely not in this lifetime. Okay, so the most karmic seeds ripen over one or two lifetimes. We like to see, make up little connections that may not necessarily be true. The Buddhist point of view is that everything that happens to us is the result of past of body, speech, or mind. Nothing is random. In the Buddhist point of view, there is no God, okay? It's karma. In fact, some people say in the Buddhist worldview, karma is the nearest thing that you'll come to a God. Okay, it is the ultimate, it's the way things happen in the world. Okay, it's the driving force. Comments, questions? Okay, we've got one in the back. While...
While we imprint our own selves earlier on, still everybody else is also acting out their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so in their interaction with us, it seems like they would also be cause and effect to us, even though we didn't instigate it. Is that...
Yeah, okay, and this gets into this, you're jumping way ahead about 10 modules. You're getting into the nature of what we call emptiness, the way things really exist. All we're talking about here is experience. The fact that you were sitting there in the back of the room and asked me that question is the
that I experienced you asking me that question
is the result of some karma I've created in the past. Everything I experience, other people, the way you appear to me, my reality, everything is the result of karmic seeds I've created in the past. And similarly, everything you're experiencing is a result of karma you've created in the past. So it gets into how do things really exist, and that's not the subject of this course. They definitely overlap, and we'll talk about it some. Question. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just to make sure I understand, so if you were explaining why a tragic death could occur to an infant.
Okay, this one always comes up. This is a great... So, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, follow up on that. What do you think I'm saying? What do you hear me saying? Or what is the Buddhist point of view on that?
So it was something that happened in a previous life.
Okay. Okay, yeah. The Buddhist point of view, it is you don't have to accept this. This is, you know, the Buddha said, don't take any of this on faith or because the Buddha said it, but test your own experience. The Buddha said that the consciousness that is present there, not that child, as that child exists in this lifetime, you know, with that beautiful face and that sweet personality, but that consciousness at some point in the past, may have been many lifetimes ago, created the causes to experience suffering in this lifetime. Okay? And that child is no different from you or no different from me, because all of us have had countless previous lifetimes. We've all been Hitler in previous lifetimes, or something equally as evil. We've all been Mother Teresa in previous lifetimes, or something equally as good. Because we've had countless previous lifetimes, and we've been in every sort of thing, okay? And those karmic seeds will ripen at some point, okay? And it's not saying that that child is to blame. It may sound like this. I'm not saying that that child is guilty. That child, that union of body and mind is just in this lifetime. But that consciousness at some point in some previous lifetimes created the cause to experience terrible suffering. Which is not the same thing as blame. Not the same thing as guilt. but saying that there is some sort of connection there.
Robbie, yeah. I don't want to confuse things, but I just want to mention
Go ahead and confuse things. This is the first class. We do confusion now.
During Lum Room class, when we were just starting on karma, Geshe-la mentioned that the lifespan that we are sort of through our karma we're supposed to have, there are some ways that mm-hmm. it ends early, so sometimes a child that dies may be just someone died too early, more earlier than they're supposed to, and that's the remains of their lives that wasn't lived, that is being lived by another being. I'm, at least that's how I kind of heard it. Did you hear it that way? I'm sorry. I'm looking for the people that were in the class with me.
I think you're on your own. Yeah. No, I know what you're talking about, and that's probably a little bit more. Yeah, that's probably a little bit more than we want to get into right now.
That's
but we do have a certain amount of the fact that I am alive from moment to moment is karma, and when the karma for this lifetime is used up, that's when I die. Okay.
But sometimes something happens.
Yeah, but in general, the fact that we're still alive from one moment to the next means we still have the karma for a human rebirth. Okay. And at some point, we use up all that karma, and that's when...
Okay, everyone else forget I said anything.
Okay, yeah. But everything, you know, our lifespan is determined by previous actions of body, speech, and mind. The fact that we have a human body is determined by previous actions. Okay, the fact that we have a mind that can understand this is determined. There is nothing about our experience that is just random or just happened. Every single aspect of it, what we like, what we don't like, the fact that we have children or don't have children, that we're smart or that we're nice or this, everything is a result of previous karma, of previous actions of body, speech, and mind. We are responsible, even though it's not me personally, you know, I can't remember my previous lifetimes, we have created the cause for everything that we experience. And we are creating the cause for everything that we will experience in the future. Johanna?
I have a quote here from, it's not a Buddhist, it's from Robert Greene Ingersoll, who is a 19th century American orator.
Okay.
And he said...
He wasn't the union organizer, was he? Ingersoll?
No, I don't think so. In nature, there are neither rewards nor punishments. There are only consequences.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to remember when we talk about karma, that the values we impose on these actions are ours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So trying to remember that helps to eliminate the idea of guilt or punishment or whatever.
Yeah. If we plant an onion seed and we don't get a peach, we're not being punished. We're just getting the consequence of our actions, okay? And if we want peaches, we have to plant a peach tree, okay? If you don't want peaches, you don't plant onions, okay? There's nothing judgmental. There's no condemning in it. It's just, understanding karma, I've referred to sometimes as having an informed knowledge of the consequences of your actions. Actions have consequences. Okay? So we talk about there are lots of words we use. Lots of times we say virtuous karma and non-virtuous karma. Or sometimes we talk about, we could say good karma and bad karma. That's very judgmental. Sometimes we talk about white karma and black karma. Again, those are kind of loaded terms. Sometimes we'll say positive and negative karma. Okay. And remember, we're referring to actions of body, speech, and mind. What is a virtuous action of body, speech, and mind? What is a virtuous karma? How do we define that? Yes, it leads to happiness, okay? Happiness for whom? For everyone in the whole world? For the person who does the action, okay? A virtuous action, a virtuous karma, a virtuous action of body, speech, or mind, inevitably, without exception, 100% of the time, leads to happiness for the person who's doing it. Okay, not permanent, complete happiness, but leads to happiness. It may not seem that way. It may seem like we're doing things and we just get mud kicked in our face when we're trying to help somebody. That's not the result of that action, okay? The karmic effect is some point in the future. Virtuous action always leads to happiness. A non-virtuous action of body, speech, and mind always leads to suffering for the person who's doing it. Any non-virtuous action, which generally means actions motivated by greed, anger, or ignorance, will always lead to suffering, to unhappiness in the future. Okay, that's how we define virtuous and non-virtuous karma. Leads to happiness or unhappiness for the person who's doing it. Very simple. Any questions or comments about that? Yeah, over here. Let's see, Susie's got the mic.
Mine was a reaction to white and black.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully believe that today's environment...
I agree with you. I'm just saying those are terms you may hear in the Tibetan tradition.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
What if you don't know you're doing it, or you do it by mistake, or you're
okay.
An animal and you do something?
If you just like you drive to Kadampa Center and you run over some ants on the way here or something like that. Okay, we'll talk about this later. If the motivation or the intention to do the action is not there, it's much weaker. Okay, but there is some negative karmic effect of that, okay? Just by, and that's part of the problems with being a human being with this body and mind, is that inevitably we're going to do things that cause suffering for others that out of ignorance cause pain. And there will be some karmic effect of that, but it's not that great, okay? Mm-hmm. Until you're enlightened, you can't avoid, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to introduce you to those terms, virtuous and non-virtuous, because we'll be using a lot. I wanted to put, for those people who took the last course, the one Don Brown taught on the path, okay, where does karma... It's a little bit of a review. We talk about the Lamrim, which is a tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, a way of organizing all the Buddhist teachings. What does Lamrim mean? Anybody remember that? Louder? I hear some whispers. Graded path, the graduated path, okay. A series of steps. I used to think it meant the gradual path, which is true for most of us, but not the translation. The graduated path. There's a series of three of steps that take you from our present state of confusion and ignorance to complete enlightenment, the state of a Buddhahood, where we completely developed our capacity for wisdom and compassion. So, when we talk about the Lamrim, we talk about the lesser scope. I'm not going to go through all of this, but I wanted the medium scope, and the greater scope. This will be a review for people who are here last module. And it's a series of steps, but in reality, when we're studying Buddhism, we're going back and forth from all these scopes, and we're working on all of them simultaneously. So before we get to the lesser scope, what's the first thing we study or need to become familiar with? The guru, yeah, guru devotion, okay? The relationship with the teacher. Okay, and that's a very complicated subject, and lots of times we kind of skip over that, but that's having a relationship with a teacher who is your guide on this path. It's said that the teacher of this lifetime is more important to us as an individual than even the historic Buddha, because that teacher is our direct access to the meaning of the path. Okay? So anyway, that's kind of the basis for everything that we study. So a lot of us may not have a teacher, but it's something that will happen if we continue with our studies. So when we start lesser scope, what do we start with there? What's the first major topic in the lesser scope? No, that's in the lesser scope. That's not the first one. First one is PHR. What's that stand for? Precious human rebirth. The fact that we have a body and mind that makes us capable of studying the teachings. Okay, then after, so we get real, we study that when we feel really good, and then we have to back off. So what do we talk about next? Death and impermanence. Yes. Uh-huh. And that's a module in discovering Buddhism, but we haven't done that one yet. Impermanence. The fact that everything is falling apart and that we will die someday, okay? This life is very precious, but we're going to die. Okay, then what do we talk about next? Suffering, yeah. Okay, so we're really on a bummer now, yeah. Talk about suffering of the lower realms in particular. And what else do we talk about? No. Refuge? Yeah. And then we talk about karma. And you may see them in different orders, but those are the main topics in the lower scope. Okay. Preciousness of this life, the fact that this life is temporary, the fact that after we die we could go to a place of much more suffering than the human realm. The way to avoid that is to take refuge, and then the way to avoid suffering is to understand karma. Okay, so these are the top main topics in the lower scope. So we're going to be sticking with that primarily in this module. Okay. Any questions or comments about anything I've said so far, or anything about this karma? Okay. Let's do another meditation. Yeah. Okay, begin by checking your posture. I think everyone's familiar with that now. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. And now set your motivation. And having set your motivation, we'll begin the meditation by, again, just placing the concentration on the breath, the mind on the breath, the physical sensation of air moving in and out through the nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. And every time we notice that our mind's wandered, we bring it back to the breath over and over again. And now that our mind is concentrated and calm, we're going to do a little bit of what we call analytic meditation, in which we use our mind's ability to think and analyze in a very concentrated, focused manner. And what we're going to think about is the question we all ask ourselves. Why? Why do things happen to me? Why is this happening to me? Why am I experiencing this? And I'd like you to just focus on that question and come up with possible answers. I mentioned we could just say things are just random. We could say that there is an all-powerful God who is determining our experience. We could say that the law of karma is determining our experience. And there may be other possible explanations that you come up with. And there's no right answer that you have to come to. Think, what explains your experience? What makes the most sense to you? That's the object of the meditation. And whenever you wander away from that, come back to it. Why do I experience what I experience? How can I explain that? How can I understand that in a way that jives with my life? And now you can bring your analysis to a close. If you've come to a conclusion, that's great. If everything's a little fuzzy right now, that's fine also. And just take a moment and do a dedication. Acknowledge the positive energy you've created just by sitting quietly and thinking about these things. Thank you. Okay, we're going to end a little bit early tonight, so people can buy books if they want to. Susie, you'll be manning the store, is that correct? Oh, Kevin is. Okay, great, thank you. Liberation of the Poem in Your Hand is completely optional, but it's a wonderful reference book. But if you are going to complete the course, you need to get Healing Anger and read it. The readings do not necessarily parallel what I'm talking about in the class, but they bring in a lot of the same topics. And the homework for this coming week is to start reading Healing Anger and then begin the readings that are online by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Meditate for 6 days during the coming week. And there are a couple points to consider during your meditation and contemplation. Next week we'll be talking about the four laws of karma, how karma works. The following week we'll be talking about how the results of karma ripen. And then we'll get into purification practice, which enables us to lessen or weaken the imprint of negative karmic imprints on our mind stream. And have a good week. See you next week. Thank you.